Chapter 15 Chang drove one-handed and juggled her phone, but Reacher said, "We should pull off the road before the tourist lady gets in a wreck for real. We should get a cup of coffee." Chang said,
"I don't understand how you drink so much coffee."
"Law of gravity," Reacher said. "If you tip it up, it comes right out. You can't help but drink it."
"Your heart must be thumping all the time."
"Better than the alternative."
A mile later, they saw a sign and took an exit that led to a standard linear array of pit stop facilities, including a gas station and bathrooms, and an old-fashioned plain stone building in a federal style somewhat disfigured by bright neon signs for modern chain store coffee and food. They parked, then got out and stretched. It was the middle of the afternoon and still warm. They used the bathrooms and met in the coffee shop. Reacher got his usual medium cup of hot black, and Chang got iced with milk. They found a corner table, and Chang put her phone down. It was a thin touchscreen thing about the size of a paperback book. She swiped and dabbed and scrolled, first through the phone options, and then the text messages, and then the email. She said,
"Nothing from Kiever."
"Try calling him again."
"We both know he won't answer."
"Stranger things have happened. Once I had three police departments and the National Guard looking for a guy, and all of a sudden he showed up, fresh back from a vacation out of state."
"We know Kiever isn't on vacation."
"Try him anyway."
Which she did, after a long reluctant pause, first on his home number and then on his cell number. There was no reply on either. Reacher said,
"Try the Los Angeles number again, from the piece of paper with the 200 deaths."
Chang nodded, keen to move on. She dialed and held the phone to her ear. This time the call was answered. She said, a little surprised,
"Good afternoon, sir. May I know who I'm speaking with?"
Which question must have been answered in the obvious manner, the same way Reacher had, with a previous inquiry, "Who's asking?" She said,
"My name is Michelle Chang. I'm a private detective based in Seattle. Previously, I was with the FBI. Now I work with a man named Kiever. I think he might have called you. Your number was found in his motel room."
Reacher had no idea what was asked next, all the way out there in Los Angeles, but he pretty soon realized it must have been an inquiry as to how to spell Kiever, because Chang said,
K-E-E-V-E-R.
A long pause, and then a reply almost certainly negative, because Chang said,
"Can you be certain of that?"
And then there was a long conversation, mostly one-sided, definitely biased toward the L.A. guy doing all the talking, which Reacher couldn't hear, and Chang's facial expressions could have launched a thousand competing scenarios, so he got no real guidance from her. He had a sense the guy worked hard on one thing after another, episodically, and in great detail. Maybe he was an actor, or a movie person. The context was unclear. In the end, Reacher gave up trying to construct a plausible narrative and just waited. Eventually, Chang said goodbye and clicked off the call and took a breath and a sip of iced coffee and said,
"His name is Westwood. He's a journalist with the L.A. Times. Their science editor, in fact. Not that it's a giant department," he says. "Generally, he writes in-depth features for their Sunday magazine. He says Kiever never called him. His habit is to make a brief, contemporaneous note of all incoming calls straight into a secure database because that's the kind of thing journalists have to do these days," he says, "in case their newspapers get sued. Or in case they want to sue their newspapers. But Kiever isn't in his database. Therefore, he didn't call."
This guy Westwood definitely isn't the client, right? Chang shook her head.
He would have said so. I told him I was Kiever's partner.
When we found it, you said the number would be either the client or a source of independent corroboration or a source of further information. So if it isn't the client, it's one of the other two. Maybe Kiever planned to call him next, after calling you. Or maybe that was your role, liaison with Westwood, about whatever.
We have to face the likelihood that number was nothing to do with Kiever. That note could have been in that room for months.
What is Westwood working on now?
A long piece about the origin of wheat, about how early wheat was crossbred and became modern wheat. Sounds like a puff piece to me. As in, we already genetically modified it, so let's go right ahead and do it some more.
Is that significant? As in, we've just seen a lot of wheat.
Enough to last a lifetime. But I'm voting with the defense attorneys. That note could have been in that room for a year. Or two. Any one of 50 guests could have dropped it. Or 100.
Reacher said, how private would Westwood's number be?
Depends how recently he changed it. If it's old, it's out there. That's how it is these days, particularly for journalists. It's on the Internet somewhere, if you look hard enough, which a lot of journalists like, in our experience. It gives them a network.
Reacher drained his coffee and said nothing. Chang said,
what are you thinking?
I'm thinking the defense attorneys would win their case, but a couple of jury members wouldn't sleep easy, because there's an alternative story to be told, and just as convincing, they're going to think, at 4 o'clock in the morning. It starts with your own first impression. Some squirrely guy with cash or handwritten checks on a lunatic quest, because the wheat is going to kill 200 people. Or something. And to prove it, talk to this journalist who knows too. And crucially, here's his number, which proves something to us about the guy. He digs up the number from the Internet. He's that kind of a guy. That note feels connected to me. The whole thing feels consistent. It's some weird lone guy obsession that carries no possible threat until suddenly it does. Chang said,
we should get back on the road.
Chapter 16. The little green Ford had GPS in the dash, and it found Kiever's house with no problem at all, in a faded suburban development north of Oklahoma City proper. It was a one-story ranch on a dead-end street. There was a young tree in the front yard, doing badly from lack of water. There was a driveway on the right side of the lot, ahead of a single-car garage. The roof was brown asphalt tile, and the siding was yellow vinyl. Not an architectural masterpiece, but the late sun made it pleasant, in its own way. It looked like a home. Reacher could imagine a big guy going in the door, kicking off his shoes, dumping himself down in a worn armchair, maybe turning on the ball game. Chang parked in the driveway. They got out together and walked to the door. There was a bell button and a brass knocker, and they tried both, but they got no response from either. The door was locked. The handle wouldn't turn at all. The view in the windows showed a dark interior. Reacher asked, does he have family?
Divorced, Chang said. Like so many.
And not the type of guy who leaves a key under a flower pot.
And I'm sure he has a burglar alarm.
We drove a long way.
I know, Chang said. Let's look around the back. With weather like this, maybe he left a window open. A crack, at least.
The street was quiet. Just 7 similar houses, 3 on a side, plus 1 at the dead end. No moving vehicles, no pedestrians. No eyes, no interest. Not really a neighborhood watch kind of place. It had a transient feel, but in slow motion, as if all seven houses were occupied by divorced guys taking a year or two to get back on their feet. Kiever's backyard was fenced to head height with boards gone gray from the weather. There was a patch of lawn, nicely kept, and a patio with a wicker chair. The back wall of the house had the same yellow siding. There were four windows and a door. All the windows were shut. The door was solid at the bottom and had nine little windows at the top, like a farmhouse thing. It led to a narrow mudroom ahead of a kitchen. The land was flat, the houses were low, and the fence was high. They were not overlooked. Chang said,
I'm trying to figure out the average police response time in a neighborhood like this. If he has a burglar alarm, I mean.
Reacher said, somewhere between 20 minutes and never, probably.
So we could give ourselves 10 minutes, couldn't we? In and out, fast and focused. I mean, it's not really a crime, even. He and I work together. He wouldn't press charges, especially not under these circumstances.
We don't know what we're looking for.
Loose papers, legal pads, notebooks, scratch pads, anywhere he could have scribbled a note. Grab it all and we'll go through it when we're out of here.
Okay, Reacher said. We'll have to break a window.
Which one?
I like the door. The little Georgian pane nearest the knob. That way we can walk in.
Go for it,
Chang said. The pane was the bottom left of the nine, a little low for Reacher's elbow, but feasible if he squatted and jabbed. Then it would be a case of knocking out the surviving shards of glass and threading his arm in up to the shoulder and then bending his elbow and bringing his hand back toward the inside knob. He jiggled the outside knob to test the weight of the mechanism, to figure out how much grip he would need. The door was open. It swung neatly inward over a welcome mat in the mudroom. There was an alarm contact on the jamb, a little white pellet with a painted-over wire. Reacher listened for a warning signal, 30 seconds of beeping, usually, to let the homeowner get to the panel and disarm the system. There was no sound, no beeping. Chang said,
"This can't be right."
Reacher put his hand in his pocket and closed it around the Smith & Wesson. Self-cocking and no manual safety. Good to go, point and shoot. He stepped through the mudroom to the kitchen, which was empty. Nothing out of place, no signs of violence. He moved onto a hallway. The front door was dead ahead. The sun had dropped lower. The house was full of golden light and still air and silence. Behind him, he felt Chang move left, so he moved right, into a corridor with four doors, which were a master suite and a hall bath and a guest bedroom with beds in it, and a guest bedroom with an office in it, all of them empty, with nothing out of place, and no signs of violence. He met Chang in the hallway near the front door. She shook her head. She said,
"It's like he stepped out to pick up a pizza. He didn't even lock the door."
The alarm panel was on the wall. It was a recent installation. It was showing the time of day and a steady green light. It was disarmed. Reacher said, "Let's get what we came for." He led the way back to the smallest bedroom, which was all kitted out with matching units, shelves above, cabinets below, and chests of drawers, and a desk, all in blonde maple veneer, and a computer, and a telephone, and a fax machine, and a printer. Investments, Reacher supposed, for a new career. We have offices everywhere. The Scandinavian look was calming. The room was tidy. There was no clutter. There was no paper. No legal pads. No notebooks, no scratch pads, no memo blocks, no loose leaves. Reacher stood still. He said, "This guy was a cop and a federal agent. He spent hours on the phone, on hold, and waiting, and talking. Did anyone ever do that without a pen and a pad of paper? For notes and doodling and passing the time, that's an unbreakable habit, surely."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, this is bullshit." He ducked away to the cabinets below the shelves. He opened one after the other. The first held spare toner cartridges for the printer. The second held spare toner cartridges for the fax machine. The third held spare legal pads. And right next to them were spare, spiral-bound notebooks, still shrink-wrapped in packs of five, and right behind them were spare memo blocks, solid cubes of crisp virgin paper 3.5 inches on a side. "I'm sorry," Reacher said.
"For what?"
"This doesn't look too good anymore. This is a guy who uses a lot of paper, so much so he buys it in the economy size. I bet that desk was covered with paper. We could have pieced this whole thing together. But someone got here ahead of us on the same mission. So now it's all gone."
"Who?"
"The how tells us who, I'm afraid. Kiever is a prisoner. That's the only way this thing can work. They found notes in his jacket pocket, maybe torn out from a legal pad, and in one pants pocket they found his wallet with his driver's license, which told them his address, which they assumed was where the rest of the legal pad was, maybe with more notes on it. And in the other pants pocket they found his house keys, which meant they could walk right in, even to the extent of these new alarms maybe having a thing you wave near the panel to turn it off, a remote fob on the keychain, a transponder, which would be a mercy, I guess. It would mean they didn't have to beat the code out of him." Chang said,
"That's very blunt."
"I can't explain it any other way."
"It doesn't tell me who."
"Mother's Rest," Reacher said. "That's his last known location." They went through Kiever's house room by room in case something had been missed. The mudroom held nothing of interest. The kitchen was a plain space, not much used. There was mismatched silverware and odds and ends of canned food, presumably bought with temporary enthusiasm but never eaten. There was nothing hidden, unless it had been walled up and artfully painted over with a finish exactly resembling 20-year-old latex base coat, complete with grease and grime. The living room and the dining nook were the same. Searching was easy. The guy wasn't exactly camping out, but it was clear he had started over without much stuff and hadn't added a great deal along the way. The guest room with beds looked like it had been set up for his children. Visitation rights. Every other weekend, maybe. Whatever the lawyers had agreed on. But Reacher felt the room had never been used. The master's suite smelled slightly sour. There was a bed with a single night table. There was a chest of drawers and a wooden apparatus that had a hanger for a jacket and trays for watches and coins and wallets, like in a fancy hotel. The bathroom smelled humid, and the towels were a mess. The night table had a short stack of magazines, weighted down by a hardcover book. As he passed by, Reacher glanced down to see what it was, purely out of interest. He saw three things. First, the magazine on the top of the pile was the Sunday supplement from the L.A. Times. Second, it was only part consumed. There was a quarter inch of bookmark visible. Third, the hardcover book was also only part consumed. It had a bookmark, too. The bookmarks were old slips of memo paper, folded once, lengthwise. They were the first paper Reacher had seen anywhere in the house. Chapter 17. The slip of paper in the hardcover book was blank, except for a single scribbled number 4, which was a number of moderate technical interest, and most famous for being the only number in the entire universe that matched the number of letters in its own word in English, 4. But other than that, it didn't seem to mean much.
Not in context.
Chang said, I'm with the defense attorneys on that one.
Reacher nodded, but the next one was better, much better, purely in terms of function, at first. The L.A. Times Sunday magazine came open at the start of a long article by science editor Ashley Westwood. It was about how modern advances in treating traumatic brain injuries were giving us a better understanding of the brain itself. The magazine was less than 2 weeks old. Chang said,
The defense attorneys would start by quoting the L.A. Times Sunday circulation.
Reacher said, Which is what?
Nearly a million, I think.
As in, it's a million to one chance this is not a coincidence?
That's what the defense attorneys would say.
What would an FBI agent say?
We were taught to think ahead to what the defense attorneys would say.
Reacher unfolded the bookmark. It was blank on one side. It wasn't blank on the other side. The other side had two lines of handwriting. At the top was the same 323 telephone number. Science editor Westwood himself in Los Angeles, California. At the bottom was written, Mother's Rest, Maloney. Reacher asked, Now what would an FBI agent say?
Chang said, Now she would tell the defense attorneys to bite her. Kiever is due to call Westwood for corroboration of or information about something to do with the town we were just in. I think that's clear. Plus now we have a name. There could be people up there named Maloney. After all, we just met the Moynihans.
But why was the bookmark at the front of the article?
He hasn't read it yet.
Which is why he hasn't called Westwood yet. Let's keep an open mind about the client. Let's just call him Passionate. A guy like that, he's on the phone all the time. He's telling the same story to whoever will listen. Mother's Rest, 200 deaths. If you don't believe me, call this reporter in L.A., and he gives out the hard-won phone number, and every single time Kiever jots it all down over and over again because that's the kind of guy he is, which is why we've already found that number twice without really trying. So maybe at first this is a nuisance client, which I'm sure you get.
From time to time.
But there's some little thing in what the guy is saying that sets Kiever thinking. But he's still skeptical, so he tries a little test. And this is Oklahoma City, right? He's likely got to go all the way to the train station to get newspapers from other cities, but he does. He gets the L.A. Times one Sunday. He wants to see if this expert witness has any kind of credibility. Is he a serious writer? Or is he something from a supermarket paper? Kiever wants to decide for himself. How long ago was wheat first grown?
Depends where, Chang said. Thousands of years, anyway.
So it turns out Westwood is probably pretty good. He's done the brain and now he's going back thousands of years. This is a smart guy. But Kiever doesn't know that yet, because he hasn't read the piece, which suggests that whatever the client said was intriguing but somehow not very urgent. Kiever didn't hop right to it.
It feels plenty urgent now.
Exactly. We need to know what changed. It wasn't a neighborhood watch kind of a place, but even so they saw no sense in lingering. They went out through the mudroom and pulled the door behind them. They walked around to the driveway and got in the car. Reacher said,
We should talk to Westwood again.
Kiefer didn't call him yet, Chang said. He has nothing to tell us.
Maybe someone else called him. He can tell us about that.
Who else?
We don't know yet. Chang didn't answer. She took out her phone and dialed it and hit an extra button and laid it on the armrest between the front seats.
It's on speaker, she said.
Reacher heard the ringtone. He heard the call answered. Hello, Westwood said. Reacher said, Sir, my name is Jack Reacher, and right now I'm working with my colleague, Michelle Chang, who spoke to you not long ago. I remember. We agreed her other colleague never called me. Kiefer, was it? I thought we established that. Yes, we accept that. But now we have a pretty clear indication he was intending to call you at some point in the future. Maybe next on the list, or maybe somewhere down the line. Westwood paused, a faint, distant beat, and said,
Where is this guy now?
Reacher said, He's missing.
How? Where is he?
Reacher said nothing. Westwood said,
Dumb questions, I suppose.
The how part could be crucial. The where part was fairly dumb. If we knew where he was, he wouldn't be missing.
You should look at the calls he already made,
surely. Not the calls he was possibly going to make at some point in the future. Our information is limited.
To what?
We have to work this thing backward, Mr. Westwood. We think he was about to rely on you for some kind of expert insight or opinion. We need to know what kind of a thing you could have helped him with.
I'm a journalist. I'm not an expert on anything.
But you're informed.
Anyone who reads my stuff is as informed as I am.
I think most readers imagine outtakes get left on the cutting room floor. They assume you know more than was printed. Maybe there was stuff you couldn't print, for legal reasons, and so on. And they assume you like this stuff anyway. And they respect your senior title.
Possibly, Westwood said. But we're talking about a conversation that never took place.
No, we're thinking about Kiefer's client now. So far, we're picturing a passionate person with time on his hands. We have evidence that he called Kiefer repeatedly. We get the feeling he's that type of guy. And clearly there's an issue he feels strongly about. I said I bet he's called everyone from the White House downward. And I bet he has. Hundreds of people, including you. Why wouldn't he? You're the science editor of a big newspaper. Maybe you wrote something that had a bearing on his issue. I think maybe he found your number on the Internet not to pass on to Kiefer, not originally, but to talk to you direct. I think he has some weird-ass scientific beef, and he thinks you would understand it. So I think maybe he called you. I think maybe you've spoken to him. There was a short pause, thousands of miles away, and then Westwood's voice came back, a little strangled, as if he was fighting a smile. He said,
I work for the L.A. Times in Los Angeles, which is in California, and my number can be found on the Internet. All of which, on balance, is a good thing, but it means I get strange calls all the time, all day and all night. I've heard every weird-ass scientific beef there is. People call to talk about aliens and flying saucers and birth and suicide and radiation and mind control, and that's only the last month alone.
Do these calls go in the database?
They're most of the database. Ask any reporter.
Can you search by subject?
We get lazy about details. These guys ramble on. We use categories mostly. This type of crank, that type of crank. Sooner or later, I block their calls when they outstay their welcome. I have to sleep sometimes.
Try Mother's Rest.
What's that?
It's the name of a town. Two words, like your mom sitting down in a chair, capital letters.
Why is it called that? I don't know, Reacher said.
They heard keyboard keys clicking, loud on the speakerphone. The database search, presumably, by subject. Westwood said,
Nothing there.
You sure?
It's a fairly distinctive name.
Reacher said nothing. Westwood said,
Hey, I'm not saying your guy's client didn't call me. He probably did. We all know people like that. I'm saying, how would I know which one he was?
They drove out of Kiever's dead-end street and out of his development and passed an outlet mall to the highway entrance. 5 hours to the right was Mother's Rest, and 10 minutes to the left was downtown Oklahoma City, with steakhouses and barbecue and decent hotels. But Chang said,
No, we have to go back.
Chapter 18 Instead of a steakhouse or a barbecue pit, they ate in chilly, fluorescent silence in a rest stop facility run by a third-best national chain. Reacher got a cheeseburger in a paper wrapper and coffee in a foam cup. Chang got a salad in a plastic container as big as a basketball with a clear lid at the top and a white bowl underneath. She was stressed and maybe a little tired from driving, but even so she was good company. She put her hair behind her shoulders and turned attacking her salad into a shared misadventure, with widened eyes and about 6 different kinds of half-smiles, ranging from rueful and self-effacing to amused anticipation, as Reacher picked up his burger and tried to take a bite. She said,
Thank you for your help so far.
He said, You're welcome.
We need to think about a more durable arrangement.
Do we?
We shouldn't start out working as a team if I'm going to finish up working alone.
He said, You should call 911.
It would be a missing persons report. That's all, at this point. An independent adult gone for 2 days in a business where there's a lot of short-notice travel? They wouldn't do anything. We have no evidence to give them.
His door?
Undamaged. An unlocked door is evidence of homeowner negligence, not foul play.
So you want to hire me? How does that work with the low overhead thing?
I just want you to tell me your intentions.
He said nothing. She said,
You could get a ride back to OC from here. There would be no hard feelings.
I was heading over to Chicago before the weather gets cold.
Same answer. Hitch back to OC and get the train. Same train you got before. Won't get delayed again, I'm sure.
He said nothing. He had come to like her lace-up shoes. They were practical, but they looked good, too. Her jeans were soft and old, and they rolled low on her hips. Her T-shirt was black, neither tight nor loose. Her eyes were on his. He said,
I'll ride with you,
but only if you want me to. This is your business, not mine.
I feel bad asking.
You're not asking. I'm offering.
I can't pay you.
I already have everything I need.
Which is what, exactly?
A few bucks in my pocket and 4 points on the compass.
Because I would need to understand your reasons.
For what?
For helping me.
I think people should always help each other.
This could go above and beyond.
I'm sure we've both seen worse.
She paused a beat. Last chance, she said.
He said, I'll ride with you. It was dark when they came off the highway. The county road ran onward through the vastness, visible only a headlight's length ahead and unrevealed beyond.
The little Ford hummed along, bouncing now and then on eroded blacktop, pale wheat stalks strobing by on both sides. Overhead were thin clouds and a new moon and a dusting of distant stars. It was impossible to say when they passed the point where they had left the Moynihans. Every mile looked exactly the same as every other mile. But the dull red pickup had gone. They saw it nowhere, not on the county road itself, or on the right-left local turns that led back through the fields to Mother's Rest, which they saw a mile away. Faint and ghostly in the night, the elevators by far the tallest things in the landscape. They came in on the old trail through the widest part of town, 6 low-rise blocks, and they turned on the plaza and drove down to the motel. The light was burning in the office window. Chang said,
"Let the fun begin."
She parked in the slot under her room and shut down the engine. They paused a moment in the sudden silence, and then they climbed out. They put their hands on their captured guns in their pockets and stood near the car in the yellow nighttime half-light from the glow of the electric bulbs in their bulkhead fixtures, one above every door, and all of them working. No movement, no sound, no Moynihans, no posse, nothing. Then, 100 feet away, the one-eyed guy came out of the office. He hustled over, the same way he had before, waving and gesturing, and when he arrived, he fixed his imperfect gaze on the ground, and he took a breath. "I apologize," he said. "A mistake was made. It led to a misunderstanding. Room 215 is yours to use until the other gentleman gets back." Chang said nothing. Reacher said, "Understood." The one-eyed guy nodded, as if to seal the deal, and then he turned tail and hustled back. Chang watched him go and said, "Could be a trap or an ambush." "Could be," Reacher said, "but I don't think it is. He wouldn't want fighting inside the actual room itself. The furniture would get busted up, and he would be patching bullet holes in the drywall all winter long."
"You saying they've surrendered?"
"It's a move in the game."
"What's the next move?"
"I don't know."
"And when will it come?"
"Tomorrow, probably," Reacher said. He looked all around, all 3 sides of the horseshoe, downstairs and upstairs. There was a rim of light around the drapes in room 203, where the man in the suit had stayed. It had a new occupant. "Not before dawn," he said. "That would be my guess."
"Will you sleep okay?"
"I expect so. Will you?"
"If I don't, I'll bang on the wall."
They went up the metal stairs together and pulled their keys and turned their locks, side by side, but 20 feet apart, like neighbors getting home from work. 100 feet away, the one-eyed guy took the lawn chair from outside 102, which was empty, and hauled it over to the spot he had used before, on the sidewalk under his office window. He lined it up and dumped himself down in the nighttime air, ready to obey the second of the evening's commands, which had been, "Watch their rooms all night." The first command had been, "Even if they come back, do not under any circumstances rock the boat tonight," which matter he thought he had handled in a satisfactory manner. Chapter 19. As before, Reacher sat in his room in the dark, back from the window, invisible from the outside, just watching, this time from a second-floor perspective. 15 minutes, then 20, then 30, as long as it took, to be sure. The one-eyed guy in his plastic chair was the same pale smudge in the distance, 100 feet away. The rim of light around 203's drapes burned steadily. Nothing moved. No cars, no people, no glowing cigarettes in the shadows. Nothing doing. 40 minutes. Room 203's lights went out. The one-eyed guy stayed where he was. Reacher gave it 10 minutes more and went to bed. Morning came, and it looked as good as the previous morning. The light was pale gold, and the shadows were long. As good as the first morning ever, maybe. Reacher sat on the bed in a towel, without coffee, and watched. The plastic chair was 100 feet away, outside the office, but it was abandoned again. Room 203's drapes were still closed. No one was moving. There was traffic out on the wide street, heard but not seen. First one truck, then a couple more, then silence. He waited, and the same things happened. The shadows retreated, yard by yard, as the sun climbed higher. The 7 o'clock train rolled in and waited and rolled out again, and the drapes opened in room 203. A woman. The sun was still on the glass, which made her dustier than she should have been, but Reacher could see her, pale, in white, standing like the guy the day before, with her arms wide and her hands on the drapes. She was staring at the morning, the same way he had. Then the white Cadillac sedan drove in and aimed right and back left into the same slot as before. Still no front license plate. This time, the driver got out right away. Above his head, the door opened, and the woman in white stepped out of her room. The white was a dress, knee-length, like a sheath. White shoes. She wasn't young, but she was in good shape. Like she worked at it. Her hair was the color of ash and cut in a bob. She had more luggage than the previous guy. She had a neat roll-on suitcase with wheels and a handle, bigger than the leather bag, but not huge, dainty even. She set out toward the stairs, and the Cadillac driver anticipated her coming predicament, and he threw out a wait gesture and went up to meet her. He collapsed her bag's handle and carried it down ahead of her, as if showing her the way. He put the bag in the trunk, and she got in the rear seat, and he got back behind the wheel, and the car pulled out and drove away. Still, no rear license plate. Reacher went and took a shower. He heard Chang in the next-door bathroom. The tubs shared a wall, which meant she hadn't met the morning train. Which was a rational decision. It had saved her a walk both ways. Maybe she had done what he had and watched. Maybe they had been sitting side by side, in towels, separated only by the wall. Although she probably had pajamas, or a nightgown, probably not voluminous, given the weather and the need to pack small. He was out before her, and he headed to the diner, hoping to get the same pair of side-by-side tables in the far back corner, which he did. He put his jacket on her chair, pulled down on one side by the Smith in the pocket, and he ordered coffee. Chang came in 5 minutes later, in the same jeans but a fresh T-shirt, her hair still inky with water from the shower. Her own jacket was pulled down on one side by her own Smith. Like any ex-cop, she looked around, the full 360, 7 or 8 separate snapshots, and then she moved through the room with plenty of energy, powered by what looked like enthusiasm, or maybe some kind of shared euphoria at their mutual survival through the night. She slid in alongside him. He said, "Did you sleep?" She said, "I must have. I didn't think I was going to."
"You didn't go meet the train."
"He's a prisoner, according to you, and that's the best case scenario."
I'm only guessing.
It's a reasonable assumption.
Did you see the woman in 203?
I thought she was hard to explain. Dressed in black, she could have been an investor or a fund manager or something else deserving of the junior executive routine.
Her face and hair were right.
And she has a key to the company gym, that's for sure. But dressed in white? She looked like she was going to a garden party in Monte Carlo at 7 o'clock in the morning. Who does that?
Is it a fashion thing? Someone's idea of summer clothes?
I sincerely hope not.
So who was she?
She looked like she was headed to City Hall for her fifth wedding.
The waitress came by, and Chang asked her,
"Do you know a guy in town named Maloney?"
"No," she said, "but I know two guys named Monahan."
And then she winked and walked away. Chang said,
"Now she's really your best friend forever. I don't think she likes the Moynihans."
Reacher said, "I don't see why anyone would."
"Someone must. We should assume they have their own best friends forever. We should expect a reaction."
But not yet. They both took a hit. It's going to be like having the flu for a couple of days. Not like on a television show where they get over it during the commercial messages.
But they'll get over it eventually. Could be a mob scene between their friends and their co-conspirators.
You were a cop. I'm sure you shot people before.
I never even drew my weapon. It was Connecticut, a small town.
What about in the FBI?
I was a financial analyst, white collar.
But you qualified, right? At the range?
We had to.
Were you any good?
I won't shoot unless they fire first.
I can live with that.
This is crazy talk. This is a railroad stop. This is not the OK Corral.
All those places had the railroad. That was the point. The bad guy would get off the train. Or the new sheriff.
How serious do you think this is?
It's on a scale like anything else. At one end, Kiever's in Vegas with a 19-year-old. At the other end, he's dead. I'm shading toward the dead end of the middle, or maybe a little beyond. I'm sorry. It was probably an accident, or a semi-accident, or panic, so now they don't know what to do.
Do we?
Right now, we have a simple 3-part agenda. Eat breakfast, drink coffee, and find Maloney.
Might not be easy.
Which part?
Maloney.
We should start at the receiving office, over by the elevators. I bet they know every name for 200 miles. And it might be two birds with one stone. If there's something hinky about the wheat, we might pick up a vibe.
Chang nodded and said,
"How did you sleep?"
It was weird at first, with Kiever's things in the room, his suitcase by the wall. I felt like someone else. I felt like a normal person. But I got over it.
The receiving office was a plain wooden structure next in line after the weighbridge. It was purely utilitarian. It was what it was. It made no concession to style or appeal. It didn't need to. It was the only game in town, and farmers either used it or starved. Inside, it had counters for form filling, and a worn floor where drivers waited in line, and a stand-up desk where deliveries were recorded. Behind the desk was a white-haired guy in bib overalls with a blunt pencil behind his ear. He was fussing around with stacks of paper. He was gearing up ahead of the harvest, presumably. He had the look of a guy entirely happy in his little fiefdom. He said,
"Help you?"
Reacher said, "We're looking for a guy named Maloney."
"Not me."
"You know a Maloney around here?"
Who's asking? We're private detectives from New York City. A guy died and left all his money to another guy. But it turns out the other guy already died, too. So now the money is back in the pot for all the relatives we can find. One of them claims he has a cousin in this county named Maloney. That's all we know.
Not me, the guy said again. How much money?
We're not allowed to say.
A lot. Better than a poke in the eye. So, how can I help you?
We figured you might know a bunch of names around here. I imagine most folks must come through this office at one time or another. The guy nodded, like a vital and unanticipated connection had been made. He hit the space bar on a keyboard and a screen lit up.
He maneuvered a mouse and clicked on something, and a list appeared, long and dense.
A bunch of names, he said.
These are the folks pre-cleared for using the weighbridge. Goes faster that way, which we need at busy times. I guess this would be all the grain people in the neighborhood, from the owners to the workers and back again, men, women, and children. This business is all hands on deck at certain times of the year.
Chang said,
You see a Maloney in there? We'd certainly appreciate a first name and an address.
The guy used the mouse again, and the list scrolled upward. Alphabetical. He stopped halfway down and said,
There's a Mahoney, but he passed on, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, if I remember right. The cancer got him. No one knew what kind.
Chang said,
No one named Maloney. Not on the list. Suppose he's not a grain worker. Would you know him anyway?
Maybe socially, but I don't. I don't know anyone named Maloney.
Is there anyone else we could ask?
You could try the Western Union store with the FedEx franchise? It's more or less our post office. Okay, Reacher said. Thanks.
The guy nodded and looked away and said nothing, as if both enchanted and annoyed by the break in his routine. Reacher remembered where the Western Union store was. He had seen it before, twice, on his block-by-block explorations. A small place with a window crowded by neon signs for MoneyGram and faxing and photocopying and FedEx and UPS and DHL. They went in, and the guy behind the counter looked up. He was about 40, tall and well-built, not fat, but certainly fleshed out, with a full head of hair and a guileless face. He was the Cadillac driver.
Chapter 20. The store was as plain as the receiving office, all dust and unpainted wood, with worn beige machines for faxing and photocopying, and untidy piles of address forms for the parcel services, and teetering stacks of packages, some presumably incoming and some presumably outgoing. Some packages were small, barely larger than the address labels stuck to them, and some were large, including two that were evidently drop-shipped direct from foreign manufacturers in their original cartons, one being German medical equipment, made from sterile stainless steel, if Reacher could trust his translation skills, and the other being a high-definition video camera from Japan. There were sealed reams of copy paper on open shelves, and ballpoint pens on strings, and a cork notice board on a wall, covered with thumb-tacked flyers for all kinds of neighborhood services, including guitar lessons and yard sales and rooms to rent. It's more or less our post office, the guy in the receiving hut had said. And Reacher saw why. The Cadillac driver said,
Can I help you?
He was behind a plywood counter counting dollar bills. Reacher said,
I recognize you from somewhere.
The guy said,
Do you?
You played college football for Miami, 1992, right?
Not me, pal.
Was it USC?
You got the wrong person.
Chang said,
Then you're the taxi driver. We saw you at the motel this morning.
The guy didn't answer.
And yesterday morning,
Chang said. No reply. There was a small wire mesh holder on the counter, full of business cards supplied by the MoneyGram franchise. A side benefit, presumably, along with the commission. Reacher took a card and read it. The guy's name was not Maloney. Reacher asked him, You got a local phone book?
What for?
I want to balance it on my head to improve my deportment.
What?
I want to look up a number.
What else is a phone book for?
The guy paused a long moment, as if searching for a legitimate reason to deny the request. But in the end, he couldn't find one, apparently, because he dipped down and hauled a slim volume from a shelf under the counter and rotated it 180 degrees and slid it across the plywood. Reacher said,
Thank you,
and thumbed it open to where L changed to M. Chang leaned in for a look.
No Maloney.
Reacher said,
Why is this town called Mother's Rest?
The guy behind the counter said,
I don't know.
Chang said,
How old is your Cadillac?
How is that your business?
It isn't, really. We're not from the DMV. We don't care about the license plates. We're interested, is all. It looks like a fine automobile.
It does its job.
Which is what?
The guy paused a beat.
Taxi, he said. Like you figured.
Reacher said,
You know anyone named Maloney?
Should I?
You might.
No, the guy said, with a measure of certainty, as if glad to be on solid ground.
There's no one named Maloney in this county.
Reacher and Chang walked back to the wide street and stood in the morning sun. Chang said,
He was lying about the Cadillac. It's not a taxi. A place like this doesn't need a taxi.
Reacher said,
So what is it?
It felt like a club car, didn't it? Like a golf cart at a resort to take guests from one place to another, from reception to their rooms, or from their rooms to the spa, as a courtesy, especially without the license plates.
Except this place isn't a resort. It's a giant wheat field.
Whatever, he didn't go far. He was there and back in the time it took us to shower and eat breakfast. An hour, maybe. 30 minutes there, 30 minutes back. A maximum 20-mile radius on these roads.
That's more than 1,000 square miles,
Reacher said. Pi times the radius squared? More than 1,200 square miles, actually. Connected with Kiever's thing? Or separate?
Connected, obviously. At the motel, the guy acted the same way as the spare parts guy who met the train. Like a lackey. And the spare parts guy dimed you out because you look a bit like Kiever. So it's connected.
Reacher said,
We'd need a helicopter to search 1,200 square miles.
And no Maloney,
Chang said. She stuck her hand in her back pocket and came out with Kiever's bookmark. Mother's Rest, Maloney.
Unless the guy is lying about that, too. Not being in the phone book doesn't necessarily prove anything. He could be unlisted or new in town.
Would the waitress lie, too?
We should try the general store.
If he exists and he isn't eating in a diner, then he's buying food there. He has to be feeding himself somehow.
They set out walking south on the wide street. Meanwhile, the Cadillac driver was busy calling it in. Such as it was, he said, "They're nowhere." In the motel office, the one-eyed guy said, "How do you figure that?" "You ever heard of a guy named Maloney?"
"Nah,
that's who they're looking for."
"A guy named Maloney?"
"They checked my phone book."
"There is no guy named Maloney."
"Exactly," the Cadillac driver said. "They're nowhere."
The general store looked like it might not have changed in 50 years, except for brand names and prices. Beyond the entrance vestibule, it was dark and dusty and smelled of damp canvas. It had 5 narrow aisles piled high with stuff ranging from woodworking tools to packaged cookies, and candles to canning jars, and toilet paper to light bulbs. There was a rail of work clothes that caught Reacher's eye. His own duds were 4 days old, and being around Chang made him conscious of it. She smelled of soap and clean skin and a dab of perfume. He had noticed when she leaned close for a look at the phone book, and he wondered what she had noticed. He picked out pants and a shirt and found socks and underwear and a white undershirt on a shelf opposite. $1 per for the smaller stuff, and less than 40 for the main items. Overall, a worthwhile investment, he thought. He hauled it all to the counter and back and dumped it all down. The store owner wouldn't sell it to him. The guy said,
"I don't want your business. You're not welcome here."
Reacher said nothing. The guy was a stringy individual, maybe 60 years old. He had caved-in cheeks, covered in white stubble, and thin gray hair, unwashed and too long, and tufts in his ears and fur on his neck. He was wearing 2 shirts, one on top of the other. He said,
"So, run along now. This is private property."
Reacher said, "You got health insurance?" Chang put her hand on his arm. The first time she had touched him, he thought. Apropos of nothing, the guy said,
"You threatening me?"
Reacher said,
"Pretty much." "This is a free country. I can choose who I sell to. The law says so."
"What's your name?"
"None of your business."
"Is it Maloney?"
"No."
"Can you give me change for $1?
"Why?"
"I want to use your payphone."
"It isn't working today."
"You got your own phone in back?"
The guy said, "You can't use it. You're not welcome here."
"Okay," Reacher said. "I get the message." He checked the tags on the items in front of him. $1 for the socks, $1 for the undershorts, $1 for the t-shirt, $19.99 for the pants, and $17.99 for the shirt. Subtotal, $40.98, plus probably 7% sales tax. Total damage, $43.85. He peeled off 2 20s and a 5 and butted them together. He creased them lengthwise to correct their curl. He placed them on the counter. He said,
"2 choices, pal. Call the cops and tell them commerce has broken out in town. Or take my money. Keep the change, if you like. Maybe put it toward a shave and a haircut."
The guy didn't answer. Reacher rolled his purchases together and jammed them under his arm. He followed Chang out of the store and stopped in the vestibule to check the payphone. No dial tone, just breathy silence like a direct connection to outer space or the blood pulsing in his head. Chang said,
"Coincidence?"
Reacher said,
I doubt it. The guy probably disconnected the wires. They want us isolated.
Who did you want to call?
Westwood in L.A. I had a thought, and then another thought. But first, I think we better check the motel.
The motel guy won't let us use his phone.
No, Reacher said. I think we can pretty much guarantee that. They approached the motel's horseshoe from the south, so the first thing they saw was the wing with the office in it. There were three things on the sidewalk under its window. The first was the plastic lawn chair, unoccupied, but still in its overnight position. The second thing was Kiever's battered valise, last seen in room 215, now repacked and waiting, all bulging and forlorn. The third thing was Chang's own suitcase, zipped up, its handle raised, also repacked and waiting.